Quite a few of the very good agents that we've got in the crowd today. We've got the guys from Plaza Homes. Where are you, Plaza Homes? Make some noise. There they are. We've got Ayana Yamaguchi, who is, where is she? She's still here? Ayana-san? No, she escaped. Well, anyway, yes, if you need introductions to good agents in anywhere in the country, don't be shy to hit us up. Oh, so yes, we are taking your questions. If you have any questions that were piled throughout the day, anything from the stream.
We've got to swap mics. This is for the panel, that's for the...
Sorry.
Okay, any questions?
Raise your hand. Tracy usually has survey questions, right?
I do, and it's...
Wait.
I'll get your computer.
I do remember a survey question. There was somebody who was asking a question on the survey about being 70 and wanting to move out of renting and to be buying. So what opportunities at 70 are there with, for loans rather than, for loans as a retiree. So that was the question. Lone person.
Well, Alicia, do you want to take
a long person here and another long person?
Maybe, yeah, perhaps I'll take it as the general home loan, which I think if the question is about a general Japanese home loan for someone who is a retiree or in 70, that could be very challenging. Typical Japanese banks will give you a mortgage until your 80th birthday whilst you're employed, though. So it's based on more on your salary and your regular income. And even then, if you get close to 60, a lot of employment contracts will say when you must retire by your 60th or now 65th birthday. So for those people, if you're getting close to that, they'll say, how are you going to keep paying the mortgage in another 2 to 5 years' time? So that's challenging. So are they already retired or they're close to retirement?
And there's also another one about a woman in their 50s buying modestly for the next 20 years.
Yeah, so if you're in your 50s, the other question was, someone in their 50s can generally still get a home loan. If you're in your 70s, if you are retired, 70s and retired, it could be challenging. If you're like 60 and you have 4 or 5 years left on your work contract, it could be possible, depends on the bank. And they may ask for extra information about, what's your investments? Do you have taishokukin? So when you retire, the company will give you a bunch of money. Or if you have a retirement investments and say, this is my assets. This is how I'm going to keep funding myself after retirement. They may consider that. Possibly flat 35. If you're a permanent resident holder or Japanese citizen, flat Sanjugo, which is a government-backed Japanese home loan system, they could be more flexible, but I don't have many experience. I think the oldest I've done is someone in like 58 years old in terms of a typical Japanese home loan. That's from me, but I believe Mark.
Yeah, Mark and Alicia might have.
Yeah, Mark and Alicia, or Mark in particular, you may know.
So yen loans, for loans from yen loans, you need to repay by the time you're 80. So we would lend to a 70-year-old, but it would be a 10-year loan. So that's pretty fast amortization. If the 70-year-old person works, then obviously we'd consider their income. If they didn't have working income, we would look at the rest of their assets.
What about international income? Was another question I had earlier. Like if you've got income abroad.
Mike.
If there is income from international income, but not Japan-based income, is that taken into consideration for a 70-year-old?
So I can't speak for Japanese banks, but I mean, I think the opportunity for yen loans is we don't really care where the income. So we look at income from around the world. Japanese banks generally don't, and that's the opportunity that we see.
Alicia.
Yes.
Yeah, for the loans.
All right.
So for the non-resident loans, really the age does not matter. What matters more is the asset itself, whether it produces consistent, stable cash flow or not, and location of the assets. Really, asset-based loan has nothing to do with the age. But so the age does not matter.
But it's still, when you say the income, it has to be the typical long-term lease income for the lenders that you work with, right?
Right, yeah. For the Japanese banks we work with, yeah. You can still finance it at 2.7%.
Yeah.
hands, questions from the room before we move on to another survey question? Anyone? Wow, you guys are really shy, or you've asked everything throughout the day. Oh, yeah, one in the back. No, this stays here, sorry, that one.
Okay. Sorry, it's just to clarify about the age in relation to getting the loans. I think part of it, the conversation was getting a personal, where you're going to live yourself, and then, of course, they're wondering where the money's going to come from. And then the other portion of that was for investments. And I was just wondering, like, you know, I probably still have a few years, but, like, if I'm in my middle 50s or 60s, does it get harder and harder to get a loan for a multifamily building, for example?
Well, the answer is no. It really doesn't matter of the borrower's age. What matters more is the asset itself.
Okay. Is it possible to get a loan despite being unemployed or retired, but able to cover the purchase multiple times over? Or do most banks only lend to people with jobs, but can't even pay cash for one unit?
If they're a resident, non-resident?
Yes, I think this is a question about asset-based lending. So, as I mentioned before, we're not so focused on whether on the answer to the question, are you employed or not? We're much more focused on what your balance sheet looks like and what kind of sources of income you have. So frankly, so I'm going to highlight this tomorrow. We have kind of all sorts of borrowers that come through the door of Yen Loans. But, you know, one significant source of interest is people who are wealthy on paper but don't have a lot of assets in Japan, either because they don't have a job or they choose to keep things offshore. And we're happy to lend to them. So not having a job in and of itself definitely does not disqualify you for a loan from Yen Loans. I think that's quite different than the way most Japanese banks would look at it.
Okay. So yeah, I just wanted to elaborate because I think those questions are getting two different versions of answers from us. So Mark is the founder of Yen Loans. He's speaking tomorrow. It's one of our sponsors, and they are a money lender for non-residents. And Alicia as well works with, you know, financing for non-residents. When I talk about home loans, it's for residents with either a Japanese spouse or a permanent residency visa. They get the typical, you know, sub 1% interest rates for a personal home. So when I speak, it's really talking about those kind of low typical home loans that you see for traditional Japanese home loans, whereas Alicia and Mark speak about non-resident financing, which is why the approach is different, and we have different answers for a similar question.
And just to clarify a little bit further, Alicia specializes in multifamily apartment buildings, and her lender, I think, requires a corporate structure.
Exactly.
Corporate structure and a corporate representative director, which they can arrange. And Mark Yen Loans specialize in condo units, do not require a corporate structure, but they don't lend for other types of properties at the moment.
We also do condos, single families. Yeah. We also do condos and single families, standalone properties as well.
And the other difference is that long-term leases versus any purpose in Yen Loans case, right? So holiday home, minpaku, monthly rentals are also acceptable for Yen Loans, but only condos at the moment. Right? Further questions from the room? Wow. This is the shortest Q&A. Oh, you got more. Okay.
Now, this is a question that's come up time and time and time again. It is about how to finance a home in Japan as a SOFA. So that's a military visa basis. And in the past, we've always said, sorry, however.
So we actually, I think from next Friday, we'll be advertising in the Stars and Stripes newspaper. We waited popular. Because we were just doing Tokyo. So from April 1st, we can lend in other metro areas of Japan. So greater Tokyo area. It was just the 23 wards of Tokyo before. But so we do the greater Tokyo area, Osaka, Fukuoka, Nagoya, Sapporo. I guess that's it. So we are going to be marketing loans to people with SOFA status. So I think there should be.
Yes, you're going to make a lot of people very, very happy.
Well, but we only can do condos.
Yes.
So that's the limiting factor.
Yeah. So
Hi, I actually am going to come talk to you later about that for SOFA. You said only condos. Is that for now, forever, or is it just part of your growth strategy?
Since you're asking, I'd say, so our, what we can lend on is basically defined by our financier. So we're not a broker. We lend money, but we borrow money to lend money. And the sandbox in which we're allowed to play is very strictly delineated. And the rationale for only doing condos in the beginning was simply that the required due diligence on a property is so much less if it's a condo. So in the future, do I think we may be able to do loans on houses and buildings? I think the answer is yes, but I frankly think that the loan size, the minimum loan size, is going to have to be a lot bigger, just because it's so much more work for us to do a proper credit underwrite on a house. So I don't know what that minimum will be, but my guess is it'll be around 50 million yen loan, which is so a much bigger house.
And you need half of it from cash you need to
get. Yeah, so I'll go through all the details tomorrow, but we lend up to 60%, and that's of the appraised value, not necessarily your purchase price. So a good way of thinking about it is a decent outcome. So appraisals are inherently backward-looking, and especially given what's happened in the last year, especially in this area here, appraisals are coming in lower than market prices. So, you know, if appraisals come in at anything above 80% of the purchase price, that's actually a good outcome. And like, these are, you know, I don't control the appraisal. So the way I kind of the way I would think about it is, if you can borrow 50% from yen loans, that's like a decent outcome.
We've got one question here, actually.
Okay. Yes. It's okay. I like to know, like, what people do escrow services in Japan when they are purchasing from the overseas. I run the brokerage firm in Tokyo, and we have many purchase requests, especially from the U.S. And Americans typically expect escrow service, but escrow in Japan is not the norm. And I just try hard to find out some escrow firm, but there's not many around. Recently, I found a company who offered the escrow service for 35 million yen, 350,000. For the deal of the 66.5 million Yokohama house deal. So I don't know if what this fee is compared with other escrow companies available in Japan.
So this is a really common problem because we sell to so many foreign buyers that escrow is just expected. And when you tell them, just bring all the money and give it to the seller, they're like, what? So we ran into that really early and we got ahead of this. Yeah, so we got ahead of this, and we actually have a licensed escrow trust account, not through ourselves, but through a company called Escrow Agent Japan. They're one of only three license holders in Japan that can actually create a escrow trust account for purpose of real estate transactions. And after months and months of getting set up with them, we have full escrow services that we can do. Not similar prices at all. It's only 22,000 yen per transfer. So you're going to have two transfers, your earnest money and your closing final costs. And then if you want to transfer from, let's say, a SWIFT transaction, so an international wire, there's an additional, I think, 5,000 yen. But most people find that it's a lot easier to use WISE in order to do a kind of real-time exchange rate so that you get a much better rate than your bank's going to give you on exchange rate. So they transfer their money via wire to WISE. WISE does their internal transfer in Japan, and then WISE sends that to the escrow account. And in that escrow management service, we provide this to all of our members that are purchasing houses with us. There's a lot of identity verification and a lot of kind of paperwork on the Japanese side that we take care of because it's like a 32-step process. I'm not kidding, like actually like 32 steps. Emily in the back has been learning the full process, and it is very, very fun because they want to be notified of every single possible thing going on about the property, about the house, when funds move, and the authority to move funds is very complicated, but we have an entire process for that. So if you're looking to buy a house in Japan, we do have full escrow.
Okay, escrow agent.
Just to answer your question, Suzuki-san, as well, in our case at least, a lot of the education that we do, because that question comes from people who are not that familiar with the Japanese real estate market, and I think it's our job as the people supporting them to educate them on what exactly the market means. I'll talk a lot about that expectation gap tomorrow in my presentation too, but one of the things to explain to people is that, as opposed to, no offense to the States, but also to a lot of other countries in the world, Japanese real estate agents are very strictly monitored and licensed, and the chance of anybody pulling any monkey business and running for the hills with your money just so that they can get 2 or 3 million yen and lose their license forever, plus face jail time, that it just, the market doesn't work like that here. It's extremely, I wouldn't say impossible, but extremely, extremely rare, unless you're dealing with very shady sellers and buyers, which I'm assuming most of our clients and sellers are not. Yep.
Thank you. Related with the interest rate, it's expected to increase in the future. Are these loans are like a fixed rate, or they are tied with the monetary policy here?
What types of properties specifically, or any? Because like investment loans are very different rates to homeowner loans.
Well, to understand a little bit of that, yeah. Okay. And which ones will be tied or not.
Yeah, most of the loans are variable, but like Emil mentioned, for the primary residence, you can get a primary residence. If you're permanent residence here, you can get a plus 35, which is a fixed interest rate. But most of the loans, people would choose to have the variable interest loans.
Sorry, can you just repeat the question? I was sort of focusing on some camera stuff that was going on here.
Rates are going to change
yes.
in the near future.
What's the monetary? Is it linked to monetary policy?
Oh, yes, definitely. I do think interest rates, well, they have been increasing. We do a monthly, although we didn't do last month, and this month we're doing, the rates have been going up. So a year ago, we were getting 0.39%, 0.45%. Right now, the cheapest is 0.64. Presti is 1.2%, which still feels a bit high. I don't think
the Americans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm talking to this guy talking in decimals. Yeah, that's right. You guys don't understand decimal. Or is that metric? Anyway. So I do think they're going up. Will they go up past 2%? I don't know. I feel there's too many small businesses, small business loans, small other economic factors that are reliant on these really low loans and really, really low rates to keep their business operating. There's too much, I believe, economic fallout. Lots of, they call them zombie companies, companies that are just running on the free mortgage, the free financing, or the very cheap, 0.4% interest rate business loans that just keep them operating. And so many of these guys will go under, like mom and pop shops, if the funding is too expensive. So I think there's a lot of other things in the Japanese economy that will prevent the government from just saying, yeah, let's just jack it up. Let's just do what Australia is doing, what the US is doing, and go to these, 4-5% sort of rates. That's my personal feeling, but I don't know. Yeah, Chris, yeah. Also, that's, I buy homes. I'm not an economist.
No comment?
Here we go. Oh, yeah. I'll go around.
So I have a pretty basic question, maybe for Emil. So for capital gains, is it better to buy a property that you actually own the land or versus leasehold?
When you say for capital gains tax?
If you're planning to buy a property and selling it in the future.
Hoping for profit.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so basically, is it better to invest in leasehold or freehold?
Yeah.
All right, which one will go up more? I believe, in general, like if the market is going to go up 10%, for example, I think both the leasehold rights and the freehold rights will go up 10%, is my general sort of feel. It's not going to be a point where they're going to separate, because the difference between them, the mechanics are already present in the market. So I think it'll be similar, to be honest. That's my feeling, but yeah. Oh, sorry, and that's my opinion.
I just want to say that, no, I think it's kind of supporting it, but looking at it from another angle, we deal a lot in condo units as investment properties. If an area is popular, even a condo unit, which comes with like a fraction of land, have been doubling and tripling in price in the last 15 years if they're in a very popular area. So while the land is the only thing that tends to gain in value in principle, it's I would look at it more as the location rather than the land specifically. A leasehold probably has less potential, but if the area is popular, they'll go up as well for sure.
We had two
around
here.
One, two, three.
Three.
You're all shy. Start with that lady there. She was there first.
Looking back 1 year and looking forward 1 year, for anyone on the panel, how have the challenges or opportunities changed?
I'll pass it down the line. We've had a big drop when the new government came in last October. Everybody was waiting on the sidelines and not knowing what's going to happen or not. Now things have started going up again. A lot of interest, a lot of it coming back. But we have lost all of the people who are banking on a 5 million yen business manager visa with a little Airbnb in the countryside. They're gone, unfortunately, because that's not an option anymore.
I'd say I think a lot more people are interested in this, at least like what we're interested in, specifically affordable homes. So, but also like the cheap yen, weak yen is really helping foreigners to take the action, because, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. I think it's weaker than a year ago, right?
Yeah.
158. Okay. But also, there's war happening, like, you know, lots of, uncertainty in this world. So that might be slowing some people down. But I would say there is more activities compared to, especially in the last 6 months. And that's at least what we're seeing.
So since Zip mentioned the 5 million cheap business manager visa has gone, the new requirement requires 30 million Japanese yen investment, which is kind of perfectly fit into our apartment building investment. So we have seen a need to park their 30 million yen into Japan into apartment buildings, because sometimes they just can't deploy all the 30 million all of a sudden. They rather put into something that producing income for them, which is like 30 million can park into apartment buildings to get you a good cash flow. That's why we have seen.
I think one of the big things, especially as someone who started a business in the past year, is the new lens on regulation in Japan of home ownership or anything to do with real estate, specifically for foreigners, is really good, because the more concrete the laws and the regulations become, the more we know the framework that we're playing in. And it looks like the Japanese government is making changes and have made changes, and they're in a good direction. Like, we think it's actually strengthening the position of a foreign investor coming into Japan, because you're not playing in areas where you don't know how things work or what's required. They're saying exactly what is required now. And that means that you can work with someone like us or try to learn it yourself and know that this is what you have to do, and they will let you do it, versus it being like, I don't know, maybe they'll change. Maybe the rules kind of, you know, not black and white, it's kind of gray. It's like, we want more black and white rules, and they weren't here a year ago. They are more here now, and I think there's going to be more in the future, and that's a good thing.
Okay, thanks. So we got two parts of our business. We got the accommodation side and then the brokerage side. I was touching on it a little bit earlier, but it's been it was pretty challenging in the off season, in the winter for the accommodation side, but the sakura season was fantastic. Best two of our best ever months. April was best ever month, so it's still strong. Tourism is still strong in Japan. And in terms of from an investment perspective and our brokerage side, I think we are still getting more interest than ever, so it's very strong. And when there's a good, well-priced property, it moves pretty quickly. And the hotel investment side, more interest than ever, for sure.
from what I've seen with long-term residents or even short-term residents that are like, hey, or you know, newcomers that have been here for 2 or 3 years, they decide to stay because Japan has often been a stable point. When the world is in chaos, Japan just sort of, it doesn't go up and down as much. It's a lot more like, you know, a little more stable. So right now you have war going on, politics in most Western countries, people are on one side or the other. No one goes back and thinks, my home country is just fantastic and I love it there. Rather, the people that are here, even you know, on a 2 or 3 year expat contract, they're reaching out and go, hey, I've heard about you. We kind of want to stay. The idea of going back after being so chill and cruisy for the past 3 years and just we go to nomikais and hanging out here and then, no talk about politics, no talk about religion, no, you know, we're not, not every conversation is about the war going on or petrol prices. Doesn't have that. But they go back for a holiday in the US and that's all it is and that's what they're surrounded by. Let's stay here a little bit longer. So the more turmoil and chaos there is out like in the world, the more the Japan bubble, I don't know if I should use that term or not, but this little space that we have here, like look at us, look where we are right now. And all those things I've just talked about. Yeah, it is, this space we are right now, you know, we haven't, all those three things that I've mentioned is the first time it's gone, oh yeah, that's right, that is the number one talking point anywhere else in the world right now. And we're here talking about, you know, renovations and holiday homes and cats and islands and all this stuff. So, so what I'm saying is, yes, it was like this 12 months ago as well, and it's even more so now because we've got, what was it, one or two wars? I don't know what we're up to right now in the past 12 months. So that's what I see. People are enjoying the safety and the comfort of being in Japan a little bit longer and are willing to settle down here.
So from my point of view, from a business point of view, I see that I think we've made real estate so popular for everybody that now so many people want to do it and they think that, you know, it's easy. So I see a lot of real estate agent or IKEA advisors, a lot of, you know, new renovation companies and all the stuff that are popping up on the market. From like, okay, real estate agents that then clients are complaining that it's more of a hit and run kind of service. From experience of me competing with some of the renovations company that they undervalue the quotations and then kind of argue for the extra money later and stuff like that. So I think the competition as well is changing. There is more and more players on the market. And it is causing a little bit of an issue because not all of them offer the high quality service, and then you know they're trying to bring the prices down, not necessarily for a good reason.
The number of affordable houses Japan websites.
And no, I'm telling you. Yes.
That's why we made
it
free. Let's get a good one.
One guy with one mailing list like a few years ago, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's actually a good one.
He's the original. And now there's like dozens of them that Anna's curated.
Speaking
of. Yeah, there we are. it's changed quite dramatically, actually, I think, for the domestic market. Obviously, this is a pretty international audience, and it's 4 years running now that we've been doing this. So, like, there's kind of established, sustained interest in the, let's call it, like, the domestic international as well as the international market. But kind of the domestic market has been a little bit slow to, well, maybe not slow, but, like, anyway, it's taken some time. And both anecdotally as well as business-wise, I've noticed a pretty dramatic change in interest, in motivation, in actual, this is both government as well as owners, actually making things happen and not just talking about it. Kind of a boring anecdote, but to me it was like pretty striking. I remember maybe a year ago now, I was sitting on one of the trains in Tokyo, and for the first time, there were two probably, I don't know, 55, 60-year-old Japanese guys in suits looking very normal, talking hushed but excitedly about IKEA. Which I had never, obviously, like all of us are very aware of the whole IKEA situation and opportunities there and whatnot, but it hasn't been really a conversation starter, much less a sustained conversation amongst, you know, normal people in Japan. And so just hearing that kind of like unsolicited, like natural conversation about, honestly, like kind of a like subtly taboo sort of thing, I thought was really encouraging. And then after that, there's been a number, especially over in like Shizuoka area, for me anyway, has been from the owner as well as like domestic government and municipality side, much more proactive and honestly just active. So actually doing stuff in the real estate and the lifestyle development, definitely in the Akiya rectification, let's say, or rejuvenation. I think that was the best word that I've heard. Thanks, Ziv, for that one. So yeah, it seems like things are, yeah, starting to accelerate. So I'm rather bullet. Okay, here you go.
The YouTube channels like the guy that you talked about today, the DIY guy, they didn't exist a few years ago, right? Now there's Japanese people actually not being shy.
The concept of renovating a house instead of destroying it.
That's new.
It's really good. I'll just speak from my point of view a little bit, in that I see a lot of people entering the short-term rental market. There's a lot more licenses being issued, and so that will have some downward pressure on pricing as more and more competition enter. And but I see that as a little bit of an opportunity, because as all of this sort of race to the bottom happens with sort of three-star and below, it leaves the premium end wide open, as Chai can agree with me. There is still a lot of opportunity up at that premium end, but the three-star and below, there's a lot of people coming into the market doing it badly, which is fine. It just means that I just have to do it differently. And people who don't do generic, who have a point of view, who want to do look after that premium end, will still have a great opportunity. The other thing that I notice as well is that prices have really gone up. So renovation prices have gone up. So, you know, any sort of work that I need done within my houses, I don't know if it's double, but it's gone up a lot. So that means I'm thinking about how much investment I'm putting into my properties to take them up to that premium level, and I'm just having to be creative, design-wise, which is kind of fun, though. Yep.
Just a few thoughts. First of all, no value judgment here, but I think it's worth mentioning that there is a part of the politics of Japan which is getting less friendly to foreigners. And, for me as a business owner, I want to be very aware of this. I think there will probably be some kind of tightening of rules and regulations around foreign ownership. I don't think it'll be extreme, but it's something that which would probably affect all of us in our room. That's one thought. Just in terms of my own personal investment portfolio, so away from yen loans, obviously, prices have gone up a lot. So, given that rates are going up, it's hard to think that there's going to be a huge amount more capital appreciation. Where I see value, i.e., where I'm putting my marginal dollar, is in the creation of short-term rentals and Airbnbs. Basically, I want to be in the business of creating these and selling them rather than keeping them for the long term because of the crowded nature of things. The last point, which you kind of mentioned, was I think given how much construction costs have gone up, the relative attraction of used buildings or used units in good condition is much more now than it was in the past, because used units that are in good condition may actually be of better quality than the things which are being made right now.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wanted to add one quick point to that. We have seen as well, yeah, the renovation condo market is massive. Any deal that we get or that we do with a client, we end up being on the mailing list for that renovation company, and they bombard me every other day saying, do you have properties available? Do you know anyone that wants to sell? They cannot get enough. And these are all central Tokyo properties between 100 million to 300 million yen that they're just trying to get because they cannot turn them over quickly enough. There's not enough in central Tokyo, there's not enough space for new developments. It's very hard to acquire land. So when they do acquire land, it's now going up to be super premium. Right? There's no low or mid-tier developments getting put up in central Tokyo anymore. It's, you know, 300 million to 500 million yen for, or plus for an apartment. So now anyone in the mid-tier is like, well, we have to go used because the new one is super premium. So that's also driving up the price of these renovation ones, and they just cannot get snapped up quickly enough.
We can do two more questions. I'm sorry, then we need to be out of here. So, Toby, you know who's first. Sorry.
Yeah. And then we have, we'll do three, one, two, three.
Okay. Yeah. So sorry if this question was asked. I came in a bit later. So two-part question, and then they're both kind of related. Okay. So my rental income that I will collect from fellow renters, what sort of tax withholdings should I expect from Japan? That's part one for the question. And then as fellow investors in real estate, what's the best incorporation we should look for when we set up a company here? Thank you.
Okay, yeah, I'll give this to Ziv.
So just to clarify, you're talking about as a non-resident, yeah?
As a
non-resident of Japan. So from a tax perspective, it doesn't really make sense to incorporate until you reach a portfolio value of, I'd say, at least $500,000 US, because corporate setup and upkeep and accounting and bookkeeping is going to be a few thousand bucks a year. So if you're not making at least 50,000-ish from the portfolio in annual cash flow, it doesn't really make sense to pay over 10% just in corporate upkeep fees. That's the first thing. Withholding tax is, depending on the type of the investment, is usually around 10.2, but you claim all of that back when you file your taxes the next year. So it's a very, very temporary expense that ends up getting back to you when you file your taxes. So that's not something that we usually factor into considerations, really.
Anybody else wants to ask?
For the incorporations, also depends on your citizenship. For U.S. investors, probably JK is a better idea than KK. I mean, the cost is not that much compared to just what the benefit it brings you.
Not the setup, but the annual upkeep is still a couple of
The annual upkeep is only you pay for the CPA, or you can do it on your own, so it doesn't cost that much. The CPA typically costs, Japanese local CPA doesn't speak any English, typically only costs about Nijigomo was 250K on Japanese yen, which is equivalent to like 1,500.
100,000 minimum corporate tax.
Uh-huh. Well, minimum corporate tax.
But you're going to have corporate tax, though, right?
It's only
so
70.
20%?
Well, if you have income, yes. But I mean, the basic maintenance cost is only 70 Japanese yen, which is only like 500 bucks.
So what we recommend to a lot of people that are buying one or two portfolio properties is to put it under your name. Don't do a GK. Don't pay corporate tax on it. And then for U.S. citizens specifically, the tax treaty is going to offset most of that anyways. Whenever you get into the $500,000 a month, definitely now you want to incorporate, just pay the corporate tax. And then depending on one thing that we found out recently is the 51% ownership of a U.S. Of a foreign entity as a U.S. Owner means that all profit on the GK, even if it's already taxed, is going to go to your personal income taxes. So that is definitely something you have to keep in mind if you do want to incorporate versus keeping it as personal taxes.
If you're accounted in Japan and you're accounted as a U.S.
Got to talk a lot.
Talk a lot.
Dago-san's not here. He'll probably explain quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yes, or a company that has CPAs in your home country or tax accountants and here in Japan. So.
We got time for a question from the chat and the last two.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is someone from the chat that said, I was told even though the Japanese property is held in corporate entity, we as non-resident foreigners will still be taxed heavily upon death. Is this true?
Inheritance tax.
Yeah, so that's...
Yeah, and then there's a follow-up, which is what about passing properties onto heirs?
Yeah, that's an inheritance tax question. So, yeah, if you have an asset, my understanding is, you know, even if you've never stepped foot in Japan, if you have an asset in Japan, then it will get treated, like that asset itself will get taxed, will get treated with the same inheritance tax rules as in Japan. So yes,
but the 36 million or more, depending on the number of descendants, is a grant.
Oh yeah, but that, but it still falls in the whether or not that, that exemption rules. Yeah, but that's part of inheritance tax. It is subject to inheritance tax and the rules and whatever waivers come with it. Yeah. But yeah, definitely. I was talking to another gentleman before, and I go, the inheritance tax guideline and diagram, I can follow most guidelines and diagrams. The inheritance tax flowchart, I can look at it, and I still not. Please get professional advice on that. Yes.
Okay.
Using corporate entities is one way to kind of carefully plan to avoid legally avoid inheritance tax, because you can give away a small percentage of your company each year, and at end you give away everything while you're still alive, so you won't be able to.
That's right. You can break up a property, but you can break up a company.
Exactly. That's why you have to use corporate entity for inheritance tax purposes. Yeah.
Okay.
Mark has something to add on there.
I'll just say people should try.
People should try to avoid dying. and also, this is serious. Like, avoid dying in Japan.
Seriously.
Dimitri. I would like to get some advice for non-resident loans for older property. Any ways of getting like a loan for 30 to 40 year old property, and what is the minimum or maximum loan amount?
So for yen loans, we have a hard cutoff of 1990. So we can't finance anything built before 1990. As a general point, and I say this not from the yen loans perspective, but as a personal, like my own experience, I've found that a lot of the difference in cap rates between properties can be explained by ability to leverage. So what I mean is, like, if you look at, so the way I look at it is like, what is my net return on capital invested? So for instance, like, there's lots of stuff that yields 7, 8, 9, 10, 11% that's built, that's very old, and it has to yield that much to find a buyer. Because so if it's all cash, you're getting, let's say you're getting 8% on the 100% that you put in. Whereas if you're buying something that's newer, you might be able to finance 50, 60, 70% of it, and you're getting, you know, what appears to be a lower cap rate,
cash on cash
return is similar or even higher. So I guess I feel like I'm trying to say, like, I invested in a lot of old stuff in the past, and I thought it was great because I was buying stuff at, like, you know, at much higher rates. But like, if I had bought stuff that I'd gotten better leverage on, at the end of the day, I probably would have been better. And also, kind of painfully, the high yielding stuff which I bought didn't rally, it didn't go up nearly as much as, you know, if I had just bought one nice thing that I actually wanted to live in this area, like, I just would have been so much better off.
Right, last question.
Okay, so thank you. The question I have is mainly directed at the Akia guys, but anybody who has an opinion can jump in. So I want to ask, what do you believe is the long-term solution for the growing Akia problem in Japan? Do you think it's just simply policy change? Do you think it's helping more foreigners buy so that most of them get bought up? Or do you think it's like we have to change the culture from Akia Kimoi to Akias are attractive to Japanese people? Like, what do you think is a long-term solution?
It's very multifaceted. I would say my previous comment two or three or four questions ago, I've been seeing a lot of Japanese, especially owners, starting to not only just recognize the potential, again, it depends on the property, but are kind of fed up, I think. There's one anecdote I'll be talking about tomorrow, which is one of the most powerful experiences I've had in Japanese real estate, where nobody's there to help them from an official point of view or from like a standard, you're supposed to do this, this, and this, and then you'll sell it. And they've tried, God knows they've tried, years of trying to do the right thing, and the established avenues for unloading or selling, or, you know, whatever you want to say it, the property that for whatever reason or however they own that just doesn't work. And they're starting to recognize, and again, act, this is something that I've been working with quite a bit and over the last year or so, starting to act on, all right, well, that just doesn't work. We tried it. We gave it our all. That doesn't work. What are the other options? What are the alternatives to talking to a local real estate agent and going to your local municipal ward office for assistance in offloading an asset? So there's that. So that's what, like the domestic owner point of view or like situation that I see. Municipally, I do not think that that's going to, policy-wise, I think it's probably just going to get maybe worse. Or like more convoluted, right? There's what I see, and I'm sure the Akia Hub guys as well are kind of seeing, is like there's like a stacking of new policy on already existing policy that's still janky. So why are you adding more to it when you could just kind of fine-tune this thing that already exists? So I'm certainly keeping my eye on that. You know, it might improve, it might not, we'll see. There's the international investment for things like what Chai works with, as well as Tracy and kind of the bigger things. I think that's still pretty viable so far as like the home, more affordable housing stuff. Again, the Akia Hub guys, they definitely have. Yeah, yeah, but that's another point. That's really what I focus on is that there's a narrative that needs to be developed. Basically, there, I mean, straight up, I think like the common narrative about I've come to calling it just not Tokyo, is don't go there, right? And it's easy to believe in that or deal with that as a place that you're not supposed to go to when there are no alternative kind of stories or narratives or, you know, YouTube channels or whatever saying, hey, actually that place that you're not supposed to go actually has a waterfall that's, or, you know, like what, there's a lifestyle thing going on, right? And so being able to develop lifestyle narratives outside of just the property narrative, to me, that's probably the most promising approach to the whole rural rejuvenation. Really do love that phrase. And Akia and, you know, just the issues that real estate and economies and populations in Japan are kind of facing is there needs to be not replacing what currently exists, but adding to it, saying, well, you could do that, but then also there's this other thing. And so I think encouraging people to explore, be that via investment, be that via short-term rentals, be that via, you know, like renovations and stuff like that, but documenting it, documentation, again, be that, like, that can be video, that can be actual property documentation, all these things. This is, in my mind, like, really the crux of the issue with digitization in Japan is that these problems that currently exist because, despite the fact that we have those tools to address the issues, they're not really being used all that well up until this point. And so encouraging that kind of stuff, I think, is, like, extremely important.
Write your local congressman.
Yeah, like that ever works.
I mean, I'm sorry to cut this short, but we have to be out of here. The hotel said that we have like 3 minutes. No, joking. Seven minutes to clear the room. But anyone who's got gala dinner tickets, we'll see you all down there at 6 o'clock. And most of you, I think, we're seeing tomorrow. If you want to come tomorrow and you don't have a ticket yet, I think Ozan opened up the ticket sales for Sunday again. They were closed in the morning. They are open again. So anyone who doesn't have a ticket for tomorrow...